Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
Greetings and welcome to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I am your host, D.B. Spitzer. And between episodes, let's see, 107 and 134, we will be talking about The Beetle. The Beetle, a Mystery, is a 1897 horror novel by British writer Richard Marsh. To tell you about it is to spoil it. So check it out, and that'll be going on from now until sometime in December. This episode is brought to you by FoundOutOnClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with D.B. Spitzer and Seraphie. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, we prefer Podbean and Apple Podcasts. Check out the new website over at pgttcm.com and check out the merch table over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pgttcm, or check us out on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, featuring The Hive, Ghost Story, Ghost Processional, Oppressive Gloom, and our theme song, The Chamber.
Chapter 14, The Duchess's Ball. That night was the Duchess of Datchet's ball. The first person I saw as I entered the dancing room was Dora Grayling. I went straight up to her. "Miss Grayling, I behaved very badly to you last night. I have come to make to you my apologies, to sue for your forgiveness." "My forgiveness?" Her head went back. She has a pretty bird-like trick of cocking it a little on one side. "You were not well. Are you better?" "Quite. You forgive me? Then grant me plenary absolution by giving me a dance for the one I lost last night." She rose. A man came up, a stranger to me. She's one of the best hunted women in England. There's a million with her. "This is my dance, Miss Grayling." She looked at him. "You must excuse me. I am afraid I have made a mistake. I had forgotten that I was already engaged." I had not thought her capable of it. She took my arm, and away we went, and left him staring. "It's he who's the sufferer now," I whispered as we went around. "She can waltz." "You think so? It was I last night. I did not mean, if I could help it, to suffer again. To me, a dance with you means something." She went all red, adding as an afterthought, "Nowadays, so few men really dance. I expect it's because you dance so well." "Thank you." We danced the waltz right through. Then we went to an impromptu shelter which had been rigged up on the balcony, and we talked. There's something sympathetic about Miss Grayling which leads one to talk about oneself. Before I was half aware of it, I was telling her of all my plans and projects, actually telling her of my latest notion, which, ultimately, was to result in the destruction of whole armies by a flash of lightning. She took an amount of interest in it which was surprising. What really stands in the way of things of this sort is not theory, but practice. One can prove one's facts on paper, or on a small scale in a room. What is wanted is proof on a large scale, by actual experiment. If, for instance, I could take my plant to one of the forests of South America, where there is plenty of animal life but no human, I could demonstrate the soundness of my position then and there. Why don't you? Think of the money it would cost. I thought I was a friend of yours. I had hoped you were. Then why don't you let me help you? Help me? How? By letting you have the money for your South American experiment. It would be an investment on which I should expect to receive good interest. I fidgeted. It is very good of you, Miss Grayling, to talk like that. She became quite frigid. Please don't be absurd. I perceive quite clearly that you are snubbing me, and that you are trying to do it as delicately as you know how. Miss Grayling, I understand that it was an impertinence on my part to volunteer assistance which was unasked. You have made that sufficiently plain. I assure you, pray don't. Of course, if it had been Miss Linden, it would have been different. She would at least have received a civil answer, but we are not all Miss Linden. I was aghast. The outburst was so uncalled for. I had not the faintest notion what I had said or done to cause it. She was in such a surprising passion, and it suited her. I thought I had never seen her look prettier. I could do nothing else but stare. So she went on, with just as little reason. Here is someone coming to claim this dance. I can't throw all my partners over. Have I offended you so irredeemably that it will be impossible for you to dance with me again? Miss Grayling, I shall be only too delighted. She handed me her card. Which may I have? For your own sake, you had better place it as far off as you possibly can. They all seem taken. That doesn't matter. Strike off any name you please, anywhere, and put your own name instead. It was giving me an almost embarrassingly free hand. I booked myself for the next waltz but two. Who it was who would have to give way to me, I did not trouble to inquire. Mr. Atherton, is that you? It was. It was also she. It was Marjorie. And so soon as I saw her, I knew that there was only one woman in the world for me. The mere sight of her sent the blood tingling through my veins. Turning to her attendant cavalier, she dismissed him with a bow. Is there an empty chair? She seated herself in the one Miss Grayling had just vacated. I sat down beside her. She glanced at me, laughter in her eyes. I was all in a stupid tremblement. You remember that last night I told you that I might require your friendly services in diplomatic intervention? I nodded. I felt that the allusion was unfair. Well, the occasion's come, or at least it's very near. She was still, and I said nothing to help her. You know how unreasonable Papa can be. I did. Never a more pig-headed man in England than Geoffrey Linden, or in a sense a duller. But just then, I was not prepared to admit it to his child. You know what an absurd objection he has to Paul. There was an appreciable hesitation before she uttered the fellow's Christian name. When it came, it was such an accent of tenderness which stung me like a gadfly. To speak to me, of all men, of the fellow in such a tone was like a woman. Has Mr. Linden no notion of how things stand between you? Except what he suspects. That is just where you are to come in. Papa thinks so much of you. I want you to sound Paul's praises in his ear, to prepare him for what must come. Was ever rejected lover burdened with such a task? Its enormity kept me still. Sidney, you have always been my friend, my truest, dearest friend. When I was a little girl, you used to come between Papa and me to shield me from his wrath. Now that I am a big girl, I want you to be on my side once more and to shield me still. Her voice softened. She laid her hand upon my arm. How under her touch I burned. But I don't understand what cause there has been for secrecy. Why should there have been any secrecy from the first? it was Paul's wish that Papa should not be told. Is Mr. Lessingham ashamed of you, Sidney? Or does he fear your father? You are unkind. You know perfectly well that Papa has been prejudiced against him all along. You know that his political position is just now one of the greatest difficulty, that every nerve and muscle is kept on the continual strain, that it is in the highest degree essential that further complications of every and any sort should be avoided. He is quite aware that his suit will not be approved of by Papa, and he simply wishes that nothing shall be said about it till the end of the session. That is all. I see. Mr. Lessingham is cautious even in lovemaking. Politician first and lover afterwards. Well, why not? Would you have him injure the cause he has at heart for want of a little patience? It depends what cause it is he has at heart. What is the matter with you? Why do you speak to me like that? It is not like you at all. She looked at me shrewdly with flashing eyes. It is possible that you are jealous? That you were in earnest in what you said last night? I thought that was the sort of thing you said to every girl. I would have given a great deal to take her in my arms and press her to my bosom then and there, to think that she should taunt me with having said to her the sort of thing I said to every girl. What do you know of Mr. Lessingham? What all the world knows, that history will be made by him. There are kinds of history in the making of which one would not desire to be associated. What do you know of his private life? It was to that I was referring. Really, you go too far. I know that he is one of the best, just as he is one of the greatest of men. For me, that is sufficient. If you do know that, it is sufficient. I do know it. All the world knows it. Everyone with whom he comes in contact is aware, must be aware, that he is incapable of a dishonorable thought or action. Take my advice. Don't appreciate any man too highly. In the book of every man's life, there is a page which he would wish to keep turned down. There is no such page in Paul's. There may be in yours. I think that probable. Thank you. I fear it more than probable. I fear that, in my case, the page may extend to several. There is nothing apostolic about me, not even the name. Sidney, you are unendurable. It is the more strange to hear you talk like this, since Paul regards you as his friend. He flatters me. Are you not his friend? Is it not sufficient to be yours? No. Who is against Paul is against me. That is hard. How is it hard? Who is against the husband can hardly be for the wife, when the husband and the wife are one. But as yet you are not one. Is my cause so hopeless? What do you call your cause? Are you thinking of that nonsense you were talking about last night? She laughed. You call it nonsense. You ask for sympathy and give so much. I will give you all the sympathy you stand in need of, I promise it. My poor dear Sidney, don't be so absurd. Do you think that I don't know you? You are the best of friends and the worst of lovers, as the one so true, so fickle as the other. To my certain knowledge, with how many girls you have been in love and out again. It is true that, to the best of my knowledge and belief, you have never been in love with me before, but that's the merest accident. Believe me, my dear, dear Sidney, you'll be in love with someone else tomorrow, if you're not halfway there tonight. I confess, quite frankly, that in that direction, all the experience I have had of you has in no wise strengthened my prophetic instinct. Cheer up. One never knows. Who is that that's coming? It was Dora Grayling who was coming. I went off with her without a word. We were halfway through the dance before she spoke to me. I am sorry that I was cross to you just now and disagreeable. Somehow, I always seem destined to show you my most unpleasant side. The blame was mine. What sort of side do I show you? You are far kinder to me than I deserve, now and always. That is what you say. Pardon me, it's true. Else how comes it that, at this time of day, I'm without a friend in all the world? You? Without a friend? I never knew a man who had so many. I never knew a person of whom so many men and women join in speaking well. Miss Grayling! As for never having done anything worth doing, think of what you have done. Think of your discoveries, think of your inventions, think of... But never mind. The world knows you have done great things, and it confidently looks to you to do still greater. You talk of being friendless, and yet when I ask, as a favor, as a great favor, to be allowed to do something to show my friendship, you, well, you snub me. I snub you? You know you snubbed me. Do you really mean that you take an interest in my work? You know I mean it. She turned to me, her face all glowing, and I did know it. Will you come to my laboratory tomorrow morning? Will I? Won't I? With your aunt? Yes, with my aunt. I'll show you round and tell you all there is to be told, and then if you still think there's anything in it, I'll accept your offer about that South American experiment. That is, if it still holds good. Of course it still holds good. And we'll be partners? Partners? Yes, we will be partners. It will cost a terrific sum. There are some things which can never cost too much. That's not my experience. I hope it will be mine. It's a bargain? On my side, I promise you that it's a bargain. When I got outside the room, I found that Percy Woodville was at my side. His round face was, in a manner of speaking, as long as my arm. He took his glass out of his eye and rubbed it with his handkerchief, and directly he put it back, he took it out and rubbed it again. I believe that I never saw him in such a state of fluster, and when one speaks of Woodville, that means something. Atherton, I am in a devil of a stew. He looked it. All of a heap, I've had such a blow which I shall never get over. Then get under. Woodville is one of those fellows who will insist on telling me their most private matters, even to what they owe their washerwoman for the ruination of their shirts. Why? Goodness alone can tell. Heaven knows I am not sympathetic. Don't be an idiot. You don't know what I'm suffering. I'm as nearly as possible stark mad. That's all right, old chap. I've seen you that way more than once before. Don't talk like that. You're not a perfect brute. I bet you a shilling that I am. Don't torture me. You're not, Atherton. He seized me by the lapels of my coat, seeming half beside himself. Fortunately, he had drawn me into a recess, so that we were noticed by few observers. What do you think has happened? My dear chap, how on earth am I to know? She's refused me. Has she? Well, I never. Buck up. Try some other address. There are quite as good a fish in the sea as ever came out of it. Atherton, you're a blackguard. He had crumpled his handkerchief into a ball and was actually bobbing at his eyes with it. The idea of Percy Woodville being dissolved in tears was excruciatingly funny, but just then I could hardly tell him so. There's not a doubt of it. It's in my way of being sympathetic. Don't be so down, man. Try her again. It's not the slightest use. I know it isn't, from the way she treated me. Don't be so sure. Women often say what they mean least. Who's the lady? Who? Is there more women in the world than one for me? Or has there ever been? You ask me, who? What does the word mean to me but Marjorie Linden? Marjorie Linden? I fancy that my jaw dropped open, that, to use his own vernacular, I was all of a heap. I felt like it. I strode away, leaving him mazed, and all but ran into Marjorie's arms. I'm just leaving. Will you see me to the carriage, Mr. Atherton? I saw her to the carriage. Are you off? Can I give you a lift? Thank you. I am not thinking of being off. I'm going to the House of Commons. Won't you come? What are you going there for? Directly she spoke of it, I knew why she was going, and she knew that I knew, as her words showed. You are quite well aware of what the magnet is. You are not so ignorant as not to know that the Agricultural Amendment Act is on tonight, and that Paul is to speak. I always try to be there when Paul is to speak, and I mean to always keep on trying. He is a fortunate man. Indeed, and again indeed, a man with such gifts as his is inadequately described as fortunate. But I must be off. He expected to be up before, but I heard from him a few minutes ago that there has been a delay, but that he will be up within half an hour. Till our next meeting. As I returned into the house, in the hall I met Percy Woodville. He had his hat on. "Where are you off to?" "I'm off to the house." "To hear Paul Lessingham?" "Damn Paul Lessingham, with all my heart. There's a division expected. I've got to go." "Someone else has gone to hear Paul Lessingham. Marjorie Linden." "No, you don't say so. By Jove. I say, Atherton, I wish I could make a speech. I never can. When I'm electioneering, I have to have my speeches written for me, and then I have to read them. But by Jove, if I knew Miss Linden was in the gallery, and if I knew anything about the thing, or could get someone to tell me something, hang me if I wouldn't speak. I'd show her that I'm not the fool she thinks I am." "Speak, Percy, speak. You'd knock 'em silly, sir. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come with you. I'll to the house as well. Paul Lessingham shall have an audience of three." End of chapter 14. Recording by Alan Winteroud. Boomcoach.blogspot.com. Chapter 15. Mr. Lessingham Speaks. The house was full. Percy and I went upstairs to the gallery, which is theoretically supposed to be reserved for what are called distinguished strangers, those curious animals. Trumperton was up, hammering out those sentences which smell not so much of the lamp as of the dunderhead. Nobody was listening, except the men in the press gallery, where is the brain of the house and 90% of its wisdom. It was not till Trumperton had finished that I discovered Lessingham. The tedious ancient resumed his seat amidst a murmur of sounds which, I have no doubt, some of the pressmen interpreted the next day as loud and continued applause. There was movement in the house, possibly expressive of relief. A hum of voices, men came flocking in. Then from the opposition benches there rose a sound which was applause, and I perceived that, on a cross bench close to the gangway, Paul Lessingham was standing up bareheaded. I eyed him critically, as a collector might eye a valuable specimen, or a pathologist a curious subject. During the last 24 hours, my interest in him had grown apace. Just then, to me, he was the most interesting man the world contained. When I remembered how I had seen him that same morning, a nerveless, terror-stricken wretch, groveling like some craven cur upon the floor, frightened to the verge of imbecility by a shadow and less than a shadow, I was confronted by two hypotheses. Either I had exaggerated his condition then, or I exaggerated his condition now. So far as appearance went, it was incredible that this man could be that one. I confess that my feeling rapidly became one of admiration. I loved the fighter. I quickly recognized that here we had him in perfection. There was no seeming about him then. The man was to the manner born. To his fingertips a fighting man. I had never realized it so clearly before. He was coolness itself. He had all his faculties under complete command. While never, for a moment, really exposing himself, he would be swift in perceiving the slightest weakness in his opponent's defense, and so soon as he saw it, like lightning, he would slip in a telling blow. Though defeated, he would hardly be disgraced, and one might easily believe that their very victories would be so expensive to his assailants that in the end they would actually conduce to his own triumph. Hang me, I told myself, if after all I am surprised if Marjorie does see something in him. For I perceived how a clever and imaginative young woman, seeing him at his best, holding his own, like a gallant knight against overwhelming odds, in the lists in which he was so much at home, might come to think of him as if he were always and only there, ignoring altogether the kind of man he was when the joust was finished. It did me good to hear him, I do know that, and I could easily imagine the effect he had on one particular auditor who was in the ladies' cage. It was very far from being an oration in the American sense. It had little or nothing of the fire and fury of the French tribune. It was marked neither by the ponderosity nor the sentiment of the eloquent German. Yet it was as satisfying as are the effects of either of the three, producing without doubt precisely the effect which the speaker intended. His voice was clear and calm, not exactly musical, yet distinctly pleasant, and it was so managed that each word he uttered was as audible to every person present as if it had been addressed particularly to him. His sentences were short and crisp. The words which he used were not big ones, but they came from him with an agreeable ease, and he spoke just fast enough to keep one's interest alert without invoking a strain on the attention. He commenced by making, in the quietest and most courteous manner, sarcastic comments on the speeches and methods of Trumperton and his friends, which tickled the house amazingly. But he did not make the mistake of pushing his personalities too far. To a speaker of a certain sort, nothing is easier than to sting to madness. If he likes, his every word is barbed. Wounds so given fester, they are not easily forgiven. It is essential to a politician that he should have his firmest friends among the fools, or his climbing days will soon be over. Soon his sarcasms were at an end. He began to exchange them for sweet-sounding phrases. He actually began to say pleasant things to his opponents, apparently to mean them, to put them in a good conceit with themselves. He pointed out how much truth there was in what they said, and then, as if by accident, with what ease and at how little cost amendments might be made. He found their arguments and took them for his own and flattered them, whether they would or would not, by showing how firmly they were founded upon fact and grafted other arguments upon them, which seemed their natural sequel, and transformed them and drove them hither and thither and brought them, their own arguments, to a round, irrefragable conclusion which was diametrically the reverse of that to which they themselves had brought them. And he did it all with an aptness, a readiness, a grace which was incontestable. So that when he sat down, he had performed that most difficult of all feats. He had delivered what, in a house of common sense, was a practical, statesmanlike speech, and yet one which left his hearers in an excellent humor. It was a great success, an immense success, a parliamentary triumph of almost the highest order. Paul Lessingham had been coming on by leaps and bounds. When he resumed his seat, amidst applause which this time really was applause, there were probably few who doubted that he was destined to go farther still. How much farther, it is true that time alone could tell, but so far as appearances went, all the prizes, which are as the crown and climax of a statesman's career, were well within his reach. For my part, I was delighted. I had enjoyed an intellectual exercise, a species of enjoyment not so common as it might be. The apostle had almost persuaded me that the political game was one worth playing and that its triumphs were things to be desired. It is something, after all, to be able to appeal successfully to the passions and aspirations of your peers, to gain their plaudits, to prove your skill at the game you yourself have chosen, to be looked up to and admired. And when a woman's eyes look down on you, and her ears drink in your every word, and her heart beats time with yours, each man to his own temperament, but when that woman is the woman whom you love, to know that your triumph means her glory and her gladness, to me that would be the best part of it all. In that hour, the apostle's hour, I almost wished that I were a politician too. The division was over. The business of the night was practically done. I was back again in the lobby. The theme of conversation was the apostle's speech. On every side they talked of it. Suddenly Marjorie was at my side. Her face was glowing. I never saw her look more beautiful or happier. She seemed to be alone. "So you have come after all. Wasn't it splendid? Wasn't it magnificent? Isn't it grand to have such great gifts and use them to such good purpose? Speak, Sidney. Don't feign a coolness which is foreign to your nature." I saw that she was hungry for me to praise the man whom she delighted to honor, but somehow her enthusiasm cooled mine. It was not a bad speech of a kind. Of a kind? How her eyes flashed fire! With what disdain she treated me! What do you mean by of a kind? My dear Sidney, are you not aware that it is an attribute of small minds to attempt to belittle those which are greater? Even if you are conscious of inferiority, it is unwise to show it. Mr. Lessingham's was a great speech of any kind. Your incapacity to recognize the fact simply reveals your lack of the critical faculty. It is fortunate for Mr. Lessingham that there is at least one person in whom the critical faculty is so bountifully developed. Apparently, in your judgment, he who discriminates is lost. I thought she was going to burst into passion, but instead, laughing, she placed her hand upon my shoulder. Poor Sidney, I understand. It is so sad. Do you know you are like a little boy who, when he is beaten, declares that the victor has cheated him? Never mind. As you grow older, you will learn better. She stung me almost beyond bearing. I cared not what I said. You, unless I am mistaken, will learn better before you are older. What do you mean? Before I could have told her, if I had meant to tell, which I did not, Lessingham came up. I hope I have not kept you waiting. I have been delayed longer than I expected. Not at all, though I am quite ready to get away. It's a little tiresome waiting here. This with a mischievous glance towards me, a glance which compelled Lessingham to notice me. You do not often favor us. I don't. I find better employment for my time. You are wrong. It's the cant of the day to underrate the House of Commons and the work which it performs. Don't you suffer yourself to join in the chorus of simpletons. Your time cannot be better employed than in endeavoring to improve the body politic. I am obliged to you. I hope you are feeling better than when I saw you last. A gleam came into his eyes, fading as quickly as it came. He showed no other sign of comprehension, surprise, or resentment. Thank you. I am very well. Marjorie perceived that I meant more than met the eye, and that what I meant was meant unpleasantly. Come, let us be off. It is Mr. Atherton tonight who is not well. She had just slipped her arm through Lessingham's when her father approached. Old Lyndon stared at her on the apostle's arm as if he could hardly believe that it was she. I thought you were at the Duchess's. So I have been, Papa, and now I'm here. Here? Old Lyndon began to stutter and stammer, and to grow red in the face, as is his wont when all excited. What do you mean by here? Where's the carriage? Where it should be, except waiting for me outside, unless the horses have run away. I'll take you down to it. I don't approve of your waiting in a place like this. Thank you, Papa, but Mr. Lessingham is going to take me down. I shall see you afterwards. Goodbye. Anything cooler than the way in which she walked off, I do not think I ever saw. This is the age of feminine advancement. Young women think nothing of twisting their mothers round their fingers, let alone their fathers. But the fashion in which that young woman walked off on the apostle's arm and left her father standing there was, in its way, a study. Lyndon seemed scarcely able to realize that the pair of them had gone. Even after they had disappeared in the crowd, he stood staring after them, growing redder and redder, till the veins stood out upon his face, and I thought that an apoplectic seizure threatened. Then with a gasp, he turned to me. Damned scoundrel! I took it for granted that he alluded to the gentleman, even though his following words hardly suggested it. Only this morning I forbade her to have anything to do with him, and now he's walked off with her. Confounded adventurer! That's what he is, an adventurer. And before many hours have passed, I'll take the liberty to tell him so. Jamming his fists into his pockets, and puffing like a grampus in distress, he took himself away. And it was time he did, for his words were as audible as they were pointed, and already people were wondering what the matter was. Woodville came up as Lyndon was going, just as sorely distressed as ever. She went away with Lessingham. Did you see her? Of course I saw her. When a man makes a speech like Lessingham's, any girl would go away with him and be proud to. When you are endowed with such great powers as he is, and use them for such lofty purposes, she'll walk away with you. But till then, never. He was at his old trick of polishing his eyeglass. It's bitter hard. When I knew that she was here, I'd half a mind to make a speech myself Upon my word I had, only I didn't know what to speak about, and I can't speak anyhow. How can a fellow speak when he's shoved in the gallery? As you say, how can he? He can't stand on the railing and shout, even with a friend holding him behind. I know I shall speak one day, bound to, and then she won't be there. It'll be better for you if she isn't. Think so? Perhaps you're right. I'd be safe to make a mess of it, and then, if she were to see me at it, it'd be the devil. Upon my word, I've been wishing lately I was clever. He rubbed his nose with the rim of his eyeglass, looking the most comically disconsolate figure. Put black care behind you, Percy. Buck up, my boy. The division's over. You are free. Now we'll go on the fly. And we did go on the fly. End of chapter 15. Recording by Alan Winteroud, boomcoach.blogspot.com.